Welcome to another edition of KUAR's Week in Review podcast. This week,
the November ballot is getting crowded. Medical marijuana, casinos, medical damages caps, and alcohol sales.
A bus carrying workers to a labor company owned by a state representative crashes in Louisiana. Undocumented immigrants are on board.
The Environmental Protection Agency moves forward to implement the law on haze. Arkansas officials cry overreach.
A victory for commuters, a loss for neighborhood advocates in Little Rock. Metroplan votes to lift a six-lane cap on I-30.
That's coming up on KUAR's Week in Review podcast.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
Here we go. So, Chris, this is like a big week, apparently, for all the different ballot proposals to get on the November ballot. These are all things that had to get 60,000 to 80,000 plus signatures collected by people in a short amount of time to get these proposals on the ballot. I think we've got most of all of it is sorted out now. The first thing we're going to talk about today is medical marijuana. I did some interviews this week on it, but why don't you kind of set the scene? There's two different proposals.
Yeah, that's right. There's the proposal sponsored by Little Rock attorney David Couch, which is a constitutional amendment that had a 85,000 signature threshold from signatures from registered voters. He got approval for that amendment this week from the Secretary of State's office after having turned in additional signatures. Mm-hmm. The main difference between this one and another proposal...
The Arkansas Medical Cannabis Act is the other one?
Yeah, I forgot the names of them. That's why.
Okay, sorry. Couches is Arkansas Medical Marijuana Amendment. The other one by Melissa Foltz primarily is the Arkansas Medical Cannabis Act.
And that's an initiated act, required less signatures to get on the ballot, not a constitutional amendment. It's one that can be overturned by the legislature. Key difference between the two, the Couch proposal does not allow people to grow their own marijuana in their homes, just licensed dispensaries. Whereas the Foltz Act initiated proposal does allow people to grow medical marijuana in their homes.
In certain instances of hardship, if they're a certain amount of miles away from a dispensary. And also some other differences is the Cannabis Act will be regulated by the Department of Health and doesn't collect that many taxes on it. It's not really about making money for the state. And the Couch one, the marijuana amendment, is run by the Alcohol Control Board, which is kind of a different setup than the Department of Health, clearly. And supposedly, I think it's supposed to raise more money for the state, one of its selling points. That's been a selling point in other states. Let's legalize this. We'll get a lot of tax revenue. It's being wasted. So anyway, let me get to this. I did two interviews this week. One with Dr. Greg Bledsoe. He's the state's Surgeon General. He's the spokesperson for one of these groups that has come out opposed to both of the medical marijuana proposals. They have a lawsuit against the initiated act trying to get it removed. They might also do it for the amendment as well. And I also talked to the former U.S. Surgeon General appointed by Bill Clinton in 1993, Dr. Joycelyn Elders, about this. The reason I did this is because pretty early on, the governor has said, this debate, well, the governor, who's former head of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, is clearly against medical marijuana and marijuana in all forms. He said this is really about the scientific community. This is about medicine. And so I will have my appointed state surgeon general give the unbiased medical opinion to Arkansans and make his pitch. And so it's kind of been presented a little bit as if the scientific community is, at least in Arkansas, is decidedly against this. Joycelyn Elders is decidedly for this, so we've got kind of a battle of two surgeon generals here. But here's Dr. Bledsoe. He was kind of saying the scientific community is unified him, especially in opposing a as-is smokable marijuana form as opposed to something that's extracted or refined.
When I started looking into this about a year ago, I thought there was a split. The more I've researched this and done some background reading, I think that there's less of a split then there is confusion over how you define the terms. So when you say medical marijuana, it's very important that you define your terms. Do you mean smoking a joint? Do you mean eating a product that contains
This is a long
marijuana?
Clip. Get comfortable.
Do you mean a pharmaceutical that's derived from marijuana that's FDA approved? Or do you mean a synthetic type of analog to the chemicals in marijuana, such as some of the things that we're seeing on the street? So if you define the terms accurately, I found a lot of cohesion around some of the main points with medical marijuana, and it's simply this. A lot of physicians are concerned about labeling a plant that's not FDA approved as medicine. And so that I would say most physicians would be concerned about that.
However, you might hear that and say, you know, clearly he's opposed to it. There is kind of a moderation in this opposition, and it's also from the governor as well. The second half of that statement is he does think there are medicinal properties in marijuana, but not just that regular smokable form.
On the other hand, a lot of physicians are also very much in support of researching marijuana and using every opportunity to squeeze all the medicinal value out of the plant so that we can purify those compounds and apply it to patient care and improve the lives of patients. And now in between those two positions, there's a lot of discussion. But when you define medical marijuana as a joint, people are concerned about all the chemical compounds that are not pure and the fact that you can't titrate the dose and, you know, you're giving one person one thing, another person another thing, and the fact that you're defining something as medicine by popular vote.
So that's kind of Greg Bledsoe's perspective. Dr. Joycelyn Elders, however, is a example of the scientific community breaking from him on this. She says, you know, this isn't something that there's not a lot of research on. She does think there should be more research into it, but she's basically said she's been looking into this for a long time, and she thinks that doctors that she knows generally agree with her that marijuana in some form, as is, does have medicinal properties that are worthwhile.
It really became very glaring on my screen during the HIV crisis, I think.
That early?
That was when I started really thinking about it. More seriously.
She was with the State Department of Health at the time.
But, you know, you were talking about treating people. Then, you know, we were talking about treating people. There was dying. We didn't have good drugs. So they were dying anyway. Why not let them be as comfortable as they could be for as long as they could be? To me, that's what medicine's about, is to take the best care of our patient that we possibly can.
All right, this is the last clip from these two interviews. But she also agrees that, you know, she thinks there needs to be a lot more research, even though she does have examples from 24 other states. Going back to 1996 in California, there are a lot of state-level medical associations that agree with her. Most national ones agree with Greg Bledsoe. She basically says that the reason there's not good research, though, is because the federal government's war on drugs has kept the FDA from really looking into it.
We should not stand in line to make sure we're last all the time. So I feel that obviously these states considered the use of medical marijuana. It's been considered, it's been used for a number of years. You know, we aren't talking about a week or two or a year or two. We're talking about a long number of years. I feel that there should be, until we continue to collect data, that we should continue to have some regulations, and I feel that it should be regulated by a health agency.
And she prefers the Medical Cannabis Act to the Medical Marijuana Amendment. She supports cultivation. She thinks that's important, and she thinks it's not about making money and likes that the Department of Health is regulating it. But Chris, can you tell us a little bit about the background of this? This is not a totally new issue in Arkansas. A recent Talk Business poll had about 80% of people supporting some form of medical marijuana.
Yeah, and back in 2012, there was a similar constitutional amendment on the ballot that was narrowly rejected. I think it was a 51-49% of voters rejected this proposal. It was, again, a proposal by David Couch, who's sponsoring the constitutional amendment this time. Back then, I think there was a grow-your-own provision in that amendment, and a lot of people, including Couch, I think, have pointed to that provision as being the main reason why it was rejected by voters. But obviously, you know, we've seen, you know, a trend of states over the last few years legalizing recreational marijuana as well as medical marijuana. It seems like a direction that the country is headed towards. It'll be interesting to see, obviously, whether or not Arkansas voters buck that trend.
And there's three other states besides Arkansas in November considering some sort of medical marijuana amendment. So we will literally be in the majority or the minority come November, either way. So, okay, let's keep going on this amendment front, though. There's three other ballot proposals to get to, not amendments, ballot proposals. Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the medical damages cap?
I'll try, because it's a complicated one. But basically, this is a proposal that limits the amount of non-economic damages,
things like pain and grief.
Pain and grief, things that can't be necessarily quantifiable in a sense of like personal like loss of income or something, you know, in medical neglect cases, medical lawsuit cases. This is a proposal that was initially, I guess, sponsored by this Republican kind of conservative think tank guy, Dan Greenberg, who's a former state representative. I think he was behind it, although he's, you know,
backed by a lot of nursing home groups financially.
Yeah, exactly. Like Michael Morton, who owns a fair number of nursing homes in the state. It would set a limit on non-economic damages to $250,000, but it would allow the legislature to set the maximum. So,
as opposed to juries, which do it now. It's all up to juries.
Right, exactly. It would also limit attorneys' fees, I believe, in these cases. I'm not sure exactly.
Well, let me interject. I just learned from Lance Turner at Arkansas Week that he thought it was interesting that it limits the plaintiff's attorney's fees, but not the defendant's attorney's fees.
Oh, wow.
So good for the alleged abuser.
Yeah. And thus, we heard, I think it was either this week or late last week, that the Arkansas Bar Association has come out against this proposal, as has a patient advocacy group led by Martha Deaver, who's filed a lawsuit to try to get this off the ballot, and another group of, I think, legal professionals who are challenging this in the court to try to get it off the ballot. So certainly a contentious issue. I think those groups that are challenging it in the court say it's a very misleading ballot title because it kind of characterizes the amendment as a sort of reform. I don't know if it uses that language, reform, but limiting attorneys' fees.
But it's also limiting the amount a family
patient,
or person.
Yeah, a patient could win as well. So we'll see, you know, how the Arkansas Supreme Court decides in terms of whether or not they agree with these groups that are challenging it. But right now, it's cleared to be on the ballot this November.
All right. Next, let's go to the casino amendment, another constitutional amendment that would allow for three casinos to be in three different Arkansas border counties. Let's see if I can get them all. Washington County, Boone County, and Miller County. So that's Texarkana, Fayetteville area, and Boone County is
North Arkansas.
Near Branson.
Yeah.
That's
right. Yeah. So it's kind of like the very edges of the state.
And the argument is they border places where their casinos right on the other side of the state line. So they would keep that money here instead of it going over there.
Yeah. And I've also heard that they're far away from the two casinos that operate now, which is Oaklawn and Hot Springs.
You must mean
the
Perry
state.
Mutual Gaming establishments of Oaklawn and Southland.
Right, not official casinos, but gaming establishments. You know, Oaklawn in the center of the state and Southland in the far east.
So I talked to Robert Kuhn, who is the spokesperson for the group that put this on the ballot, Arkansas Wins 2016. And there have been a number of other attempts to put casinos on the ballot recently. And a lot of times, I think voters in those past instances objected because it would be something very specific, like put in the state constitution or have a state law that the casino that's going to open is going to be called Nancy Todd's Poker Palace and her company's going to get to own the casino. And it's kind of the same thing with this, although it's a little bit harder to tell. But basically, these three casinos that are opening, three different private companies, limited liability corporations, will be written by name into the state constitution, which has, I think, never happened before. And one of them is in Missouri. These are people with private owners. They're the ones who put it on the ballot. That's why their company's names are in there. And each one of these LLCs is named after their county they're in, and they get to decide how the casino's operated. The one in Washington County has already reached a agreement with the Cherokee Nation to operate the casino. So Gwen Moritz, who's the editor of Arkansas Business, she just raises this all the time, wherever she can, on Twitter and stuff like that. She says, like, how drastic to list three private companies in the state constitution as the companies that get to run this. Where Oaklawn and the other stuff, there's very specified things about what can be allowed, but I don't think the companies are actually in the state's constitution anywhere. Anyway, so here's Robert Kuhn's explanation. I interviewed him, and he was kind enough to talk. He was overseas somewhere, but called back. And
he's the spokesman for Arkansas Wins in 2016. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, he kind of laughed. I said I was going to be Gwen Moritz's mouthpiece, but he answered.
basically taking a similar tax as what's currently on the books with existing gaming facilities that we have today. I mean, there are specific constitutional permissions for parimutuel gaming, which is what we have in Hot Springs and West Memphis. And then you have essentially specific entities that are enabled to participate in electronic games of skill based on that permission. So in concept, what we're doing is not all that different. I think tactically it's different, but ultimately it's up to the voters to decide if that's something that they want to sign off on.
And if it is approved, there'd be a 5-member commission appointed by the governor to regulate these casinos within the confines of what's specified in the amendment. And unlike Oaklawn and Southland, which have to use games of skill, so to speak, these would be able to do any kind of gambling you'd see in, I think, any other state. I think it specifically says something about, like, you can do the type of operations that happen in Nevada. So we'll see what happens with that coming up. There's one more thing we need to talk about. And this is not a statewide level ballot proposal, but there's been a lot of action on different county-wide wet-dry alcohol sales.
Yeah, I want to briefly mention this because we talked about it on the podcast last week. And just as a follow-up, like I said last week, there was a lawsuit against the Independence County petition drive as well as the Randolph County petition drive, where the county clerks in those two counties, actually it was the lawsuits were brought by the group sponsoring the petition drives against the county clerks there, who had invalidated a certain number of signatures because these signatures, even though they were valid, they were on the pages of other invalid signatures, and so they were disqualified, setting these groups below this kind of 38% threshold of signatures from registered voters needed to have this measure on the ballot in November for this question of whether or not to have alcohol sales. I told you last week the Independence County folks lost their lawsuit. Mm-hmm. Turns out this week also the Randolph County people lost their lawsuit in circuit court over the basically the exact same issue. The judge there found that the law with these restrictions on petition gathering was constitutional. And additionally, what I did not tell you last week was that the Johnson County initiative, which had been approved by their county clerk, got a lawsuit delivered to them by opponents of their measure challenging the petition gathering process. And a judge there ruled against that petition, and that's going to be off the ballot. And the Johnson County folks say they're not going to challenge that. And also Crawford County, they didn't get enough signatures. The clerk there ruled. So as of now, the only county that's going to have this wet, dry local option on the ballot this November is Little River County down in southwest Arkansas, as well as the town of Farmington up in Washington County.
All right, we can get reports from KUAF in Fayetteville and KTXK in Texarkana on both of those issues as we approach the election. Also, maybe worth noting that Keith Ingram, who is a state senator from West Memphis, which has Southland Gaming, he was one of the people that helped sponsor this legislation to change the petition gathering requirements. The theory is that they didn't want other casinos opening up, and so let's make it harder for them to get on the ballot.
Yeah, I spoke with him today. Well, actually, this specific law that's been challenged applies only to alcohol petition drives, which is interesting.
Because the original law was challenged in court, right? But that ruling only affected the statewide.
Yeah, there was a statewide law on petition gathering that was challenged in court, and parts of it were struck down by the Arkansas Supreme Court. But in these circuit court rulings this week and last week, the circuit judge said that Supreme Court ruling did not apply in these cases because of this separate law, which is the one that was sponsored by Keith Ingram. His law was actually a revision of a previous law, so it had this requirement for the 38% threshold already in it, but the new law added these regulations on the petition page.
Can't have one error on the page or the whole page is
fine. Yeah, and I spoke with him earlier today, and he was basically defending it because he felt there was a lot of, in his words, fraud and abuse, in terms of the petition gathering process up until that time, because a lot of paid canvassers, have been used, and they try to get as many petitions because they're in signatures because they're paid based on signatures.
Worth noting, though, that the Secretary of State validates all the signatures, and if they found one by paid canvassers that was from a different county, they would not count it.
In cases of statewide petitions, or
well, in the past, I mean that. Keith England's argument.
Yeah, in the past, yeah.
It's not as if just because a paid canvasser got it that it counts.
Yeah. I mean, you know, exactly. That definitely is the counter argument in that whether you're paid or not, the signatures are the same in terms of the validation process.
Seems like a little bit of discrimination, too. I mean, political campaigns are no stranger to outside help coming in to help manage them, whether it's a ballot committee or an election or anything like that. You know, it's common because of the seasonal nature of campaigns that people move around and do that stuff. All right. Well, I also want to say Governor Asa Hutchinson opposes the casino amendment. Okay. Let's move on to the Environmental Protection Agency, a big win for Sierra Club and perhaps for our state's forests as well, if you believe the science.
Yeah, this was a final rule or plan issued this week by the Environmental Protection Agency on regional haze, kind of a section of a Clean Air Act, a rule that was passed by Congress in 1999, telling states that they had to improve air quality over wilderness areas in the country. There are about 64 wilderness areas. In Arkansas, we have two, the Upper Buffalo and the Caney Creek wilderness areas. And the EPA was tasked with regulating the air quality and visibility standards in these. And by doing so, they told the state agencies that they had to develop a plan to improve these air quality measures. And basically what happened was after this law was passed, the state had submitted a plan in the late 2000s, and the EPA said, no, that's a bad plan, back in 2012.
The state of Arkansas didn't want to comply with the EPA?
Well, I guess they tried to comply, but there was disagreement between the two agencies as far as the actual compliance plan itself. So jump forward to 2014, we still don't have a plan. The Sierra Club files a lawsuit against the EPA to force a state plan. Last year, a federal judge ruled that the EPA just has to make a plan for the state. Just do it. Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality didn't like that, but they had to go along with it. There was a public comment process. Anyways, so Thursday, the EPA finally released this plan for the state's utilities, power plants, and one paper mill to reduce emissions. I spoke with Guy Donaldson. He's the EPA Region 6 Air Chief Division Director. Region 6 basically encompasses like Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, you know, various states. Here he is talking about the key part of this plan.
The big thing here is the sulfur dioxide emissions. Those are emissions that combine in the atmosphere to form ammonia sulfate. And the way to control those traditionally, what we based our plan on was the idea of putting scrubbers in place. And so those are just essentially what they sound like. They use a reagent that is injected into the gas stream and scrubs the pollutants out. So having said that, that's what we base the emission limits we put in our plan. We don't require a specific technology, so if a source can come up with a different technology than scrubbers to meet the same emission limits, they are certainly available to do that. We think the scrubbers are a proven technology that have been implemented at probably hundreds of facilities across the country, and we believe they're cost-effective and technically effective controls.
And so, like I said, this affects mostly power plants. Seven facilities in Arkansas, three are coal plants, three are natural gas plants, and one is a paper mill down in South Arkansas somewhere. Entergy Arkansas doesn't like this because they say it's going to cost them $1 billion to put a scrub.
$2 billion.
$2 billion. Well, $1 billion for each plant, the Independence Coal Power Plant up in northeast Arkansas and the White Bluff plant in Redfield, which is kind of by Pine Bluff. They say, combined $2 billion, and they don't like that, obviously. They had proposed last year closing down those plants in compliance with this plan, but they're still not sure. I spoke with Julie Munzel, their spokeswoman, about the other options.
There, you could contest the process. That's another option. So there could be, in the future, when I say contest the process, you could be looking down the road at litigation. That's another option. And like I said, for us, we need to go back and review all of those and the implications of all those before we can make a final decision.
And our governor, Asa Hutchinson, and also ADEQ Director Becky Keough also came out with statements. I spoke with Keough. We don't have any cuts with her. But basically, she's echoed what Julie Munsell said in that the state is also looking for other options. The governor, in his statement, said he is mindful of litigation in surrounding states regarding their haze plans. And he has directed ADEQ to work with the Arkansas Attorney General to pursue all available legal remedies, quote unquote. And Keough even said in her statement that despite Arkansas achieving better than required progress in visibility improvements, EPA has ignored the uniquely American cooperative federalism model and instead has elected to issue this federal plan and converted this partnership into a coercive federalism scheme where the states are now more pawn than partner. So it gives you a sense of what our state officials think about it. The Sierra Club, of course, Glenn Hooks, director of Arkansas Sierra Club, praised this rule. Of course, he was expecting it. And, you know, we'll see, you know, whether or not a federal court will listen to Arkansas officials' demands. Right now, I think the timeline for these utilities to install scrubbers and clean up their air is about 5 years. And by the way, the amount of emissions that would be reduced by this plan, the EPA estimates about 68,000 tons of sulfur dioxide from the atmosphere in Arkansas, about 15,000 tons of nitrogen oxide. And that doesn't include particulate matter, which comes out of coal plants, or carbon emissions for that matter.
All right, switching gears back to politics now. We're finished with the ballot proposals. Here's kind of a quirky story from the state legislature going on. So it's kind of a national news story over the course of this last weekend, actually. There was a bus carrying about 50 or so people in Louisiana. They were mostly laborers going to help do some flood restoration work because of all the flooding in Baton Rouge. You know, clearly labor is needed there and stuff like that. So there's a state representative, Dave Wallace, in Leechville, all the way, way up in northeast Arkansas. But he runs a company with some other people, including some Louisiana officials, that is basically like temporary work and labor help. And he's operating a job center out of Baton Rouge, sending workers to different projects to work on. And well, this bus that was carrying people to his company, it crashed on the interstate. Turns out there's an undocumented immigrant without a driver's license driving the bus. Many, many people on the bus are also undocumented immigrants. They're all going to Dave Wallace's company to seek work. However, Dave Wallace, I tried to talk to him about this to try to figure out what was going on. Were these people working for him at the time? Did he know that they were undocumented immigrants? This is maybe a little bit cruel, but he didn't really want to talk.
Jesse Wimberly.
Just give me his attorney's name.
Our point of contact down in New Orleans. He's our attorney. And I want to ask that you speak with him.
And why do you feel you shouldn't speak for yourself?
Because I have attorneys to do things like this for me.
You don't feel, though, because you're a state representative, that you feel the public may be something different than a regular business owner?
You have a phone number. I've given it to you. You're welcome to give him a call. Thank you very much.
So kind of brief conversation with Dave Wallace. And I called him because earlier in the day, he had given a number of Louisiana media outlets who had gotten to the story pretty quickly. He'd given them quotes about this, saying he didn't know they're undocumented. But I guess his attorney got to him after a while and told him to stop doing that. He stopped giving quotes to Arkansas media. So here's his attorney, Jesse Wimberly, and he basically claims there might have been undocumented immigrant people on that bus. However, and you know, and they were headed to Wallace's company, but he says they weren't employees at the time. They were just going to the center to be processed and had their paperwork checked.
The bus was chartered by a fellow named Edgar Ruta, who is a headhunter who tries to bring in a potential labor pool for these temporary employment services like WRS. He hired the bus. The bus company put this fella as a driver who was undocumented. The bus was going to bring a potential group of potential employees to WRS's facility in Baton Rouge, where they'd be checked out for paperwork, for legality, etc., and put to work if they could.
So that's the argument. I mean, I don't know if they paid for this bus ride, who paid for the bus ride, you know, if they're not employees yet. It's also worth noting that there would probably be independent contractors, so they're not technically an employee in that sense either. Mm. But here's what happened earlier in the day. Louisiana TV station WWL-TV, they said the driver of the bus, Dennis Rodriguez of Honduras, that he had been working for this man, Edgar Ruta, that the attorney mentioned, doing construction jobs over the last year for that company. So maybe he wasn't employed technically at that moment while he was driving the bus, but he has worked on many projects for them over the course of the year, was going to work on another project. Maybe they messed up his paperwork in the past and they were going to catch it this time. And some other people on the bus said that they were part of a regular work crew that had worked with this entity before. So we'll see what happens with that. Probably not too much. But Dave Wallace, he's a state representative, Republican. He's running for state Senate against Democratic Senator David Burnett of Osceola. All right, this is the last topic on our podcast this week. Chris, you've been following this story for too long, it feels like.
And it'll be much longer yet.
So the federally mandated Transportation Planning Authority in Central Arkansas Metroplan, their board of directors gave a big green light to expanding I-30 from 6 lanes to possibly up to 10.
Yeah, that's right. It's a group of about 30 or so county judges, as well as mayors from around Central Arkansas and other transportation officials. They set the transportation policy for the region, and written into this planning document, this long-range planning document they have called Imagine Central Arkansas, is language written in there that says no freeway in the region should be wider than 6 lanes. Now, the Highway Department, State Highway Department, and its 30 crossing project through North Little Rock and Little Rock has, as time and again we've heard, wanted to expand the freeway there, this 7-mile portion of freeway, to about 10 lanes or 8 lanes, depending on what plan you look at. So in order to do that, they had to get this approval from Metroplan. And so this week, the county judges and mayors, they met and they voted to approve it. I was there. There were a lot of impassioned arguments from citizens before the group took the vote, which was nearly unanimous. The only person voting against it was Jared Varner, who's the executive director of Rock Region Metro. Actually, let's go ahead and hear from him.
Came as no surprise to this group. Obviously, I think it's very intuitive that the transit agency in our region would not necessarily be major advocates for significant highway widening. In our state and in our region, we're just investing too much in roadway expansion and not enough money into transit and pedestrian improvements and other things that we feel is where our resources should be going.
When he talks about the major investment, this is a $600 million project estimated, whereas Pulaski County voters just recently rejected a half-cent sales tax to go towards the public transit system. So, like I said, number of impassioned speeches by citizens, as we've seen and heard from a lot of these public meetings of the last few months about
the majority,
this project.
The majority of public comments are opposed to this, according to
Sides. Yeah, they are. I forget the exact number. I don't have it in front of me, but there's more than 100 public comments against this rule change and slightly less sent to Metroplan that were in favor of it. A lot of neighborhood groups from around Little Rock oppose this. Chief among them is Kathy Wells in the Coalition of Greater Little Rock Neighborhoods. She spoke with reporters after this vote.
Opponents to this current proposal will redouble our efforts. And I think we have given them a very reasonable step to take next, which is to support a resolution for an environmental impact statement. What's going on right now is far less detailed and far more limited. And the full impact statement offers the chance to look at these alternatives that have been put aside or they wouldn't even look at in the first place. And we have time with the delay we heard about today to get going on that. It is disappointing that the mayor of Little Rock has so wholly embraced the state proposal, full stop. It is disappointing that none of the officials who have endorsed this over the weekend, Judge Hyde, Mayor Smith, and Mayor Stodola, have dealt with the very high cost, the inevitable next required actions, the possibility that we may still do other things. and we are going to redouble our efforts to try and get them to recognize that these state professionals got it wrong.
So she referred in there to an environmental impact statement. There is currently a federally mandated environmental study underway on this project. At the Metroplan meeting, one of the staffers said that study has been delayed and it's expected to be released next March. So quite a ways away from now. And so she was kind of critical of the fact that the board rushed this decision before even seeing that. I did talk with Mayor Joe Smith of North Little Rock about this environmental study and whether or not he has any concerns about what it might mean.
No, I mean, we've looked at that. Not that I'm an environmental engineer, but we can always change our mind if this environmental study comes back and looks awful. But timing-wise, it was necessary for us to go ahead and waive the resolution that we approved today.
So there you have it. And, you know, just to review just slightly, neighborhood groups just generally believe that this project is going to further divide the city. You heard the reasons from Jared Varner for opposing it, that investing in infrastructure for cars is not the right way to go for generations to come. We're shaping the city and surrounding communities for many decades by doing this. So basically what's going to happen next is Metroplan Board is going to have to also amend the long-range planning document that I told you about earlier, as well as a separate, what's called a transportation improvement document, and also the environmental study is going to have to be complete before the highway department can carry through with this. And as a last, one last thing, and I'll finish right after this, you heard there Kathy Wells mentioning Barry Hyde, Pulaski County Judge, Mayor Mark Stola, and Joe Smith of North Little Rock, Mayor. They all have endorsed this highway department plan for a split diamond interchange in downtown Little Rock, which would direct traffic from I-30 away from its current setup onto 2nd Street, and the exits and on-ramps would go on 4th and 6th Street. And it would allow for the creation of a Central Park downtown, which the mayor of Little Rock has, Mark Stola,
or what some people call a Central Park.
Yeah, he's gotten some flack for this at that meeting. He was kind of made an impassioned argument in favor of it. He said he really believes that it could be like a 17-acre park down by the library. I don't know. We'll see. You know, the city certainly doesn't have a whole lot of money to improve infrastructures, and the creation of the park would not be funded by the State Highway Department.
Even though they approved the waiver, it's not the same exact design, the 30 crossing design they originally brought. They did get some stuff out of it that they wanted. I just want to note that it's kind of interesting with Metroplan that it's a regional transportation planning agency because, you know, interstates especially, regional transportation. But the impact of this, it's obviously good for commuters who don't live in downtown Little Rock. It's easy to get there. But the impact in Little Rock is felt by people in Little Rock, not Mayor Joe Smith necessarily. I guess he could feel North Little Rock. But all these other mayors from surrounding towns around Little Rock are making decisions that impact the River Market District. Just something to kind of consider.
It's a hard thing to I guess, reconcile these two, I don't know what you call them, factions of the commuting public from outside of the area and the community inside the immediate area.
Because that same
affected
road has to serve both of their purposes.
Right,
they might be at odds.
We've seen this public debate over the last few months. And I think the Highway Department's plan for that split diamond interchange is an attempt to reconcile those two kind of competing views. They certainly have changed their plan, like you said, quite a bit since their initial plan came out. But as you heard Kathy Wells say, I mean, they're still pretty dead set opposed to any kind of expansion of I-30.
Right.
And they even, she even suggested the possibility of a lawsuit, federal lawsuit, to halt the project.
Well, here's my parting joke on all of this. For all the people that have always said the Clinton Library looks like a trailer or something, what's more American than a highway running through a trailer park's front yard? Okay, so this has been our Week in Review podcast. We've covered way more than I thought we were going to when we started out at this one, but thanks for sticking through. The KUAR's Week in Review podcast is editorially independent of our license holder, University of Arkansas at Little Rock. I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
Thanks for listening, and remember to subscribe to us on iTunes.